Dramatic reading A for use with step one. Our stories, a dramatic reading. In the words of the Reverend Sarah Carpenter Vazick, a transgender female educator.
The key to understanding conflicts in gender identity is to bear in mind that most individuals never think about their gender. They have no reason to. They're content with the gender they were assigned at birth and are comfortable with how it does or does not affect their lives. But some begin to question why they don't feel they fit the gender assigned to them at birth and the gender everyone tells them they are. This may begin as early as 5 years of age. In short, the transgender child is thinking, wait a minute, this is not who I am. Why are people saying this is me? Why are they making me do this?
Rabbi Elliot Rose Kukla, a transgender man serving as a rabbi at the Bay Area Jewish Healing Center in San Francisco, offers an example of society's gender expectations.
Gender rigidity affects all of us, even if we are not transgender. Ronnie Parrish Jr., a 3-year-old boy, was beaten to death by his father in 2005 for not acting masculine enough. Ronnie's story illustrates the fact that the belief that there are only two ways to be human leads to multiple types of violence and oppression. It limits and circumscribes everyone's potential.
Dr. Virginia Ramey Mollenkott, a retired professor from Patterson College and an author of many books, including one entitled Omnigender, gives another example.
We are living in a time when a 15-year-old boy was shot to death for wearing eyeshadow and high heels to school and for expressing his attraction to a boy a year younger than himself.
Again, Reverend Sarah Carpenter Vazick explains.
As a child progresses through school, gender expectations become stronger and are only enhanced by pressure from friends and classmates. Failure to live up to these expectations often leads to labels such as sissy, and quite frequently more vulgar and obscene nicknames, causing the child to become increasingly despondent and depressed as the internal conflict deepens. For a teenager, it would have been, until very recently, almost impossible to find someone qualified to talk about gender identity or to find useful information on the topic, thus making the conflict even more firmly embedded. This conflict over gender often leads to deep depression and anxiety, and an attempt is all too frequently made to suppress these feelings with alcohol and substance abuse. When all else fails, many transgender youth believe that suicide presents the only viable option.
Dana Beyer, MD, a transgender woman and retired surgeon turned politician, tells of her experience growing up in a yeshiva.
Judaism is a religion that can be both welcoming and fear-inducing simultaneously. As a child in a yeshiva, or Jewish day school, where I spent 10 hours or more daily learning my math, chemistry, and scripture, I felt both at home and fearful that I would be struck dead at any minute. There is a morning prayer still recited by Orthodox men, and because I was in an Orthodox school, I was obligated to say it as well. It goes, "Blessed art thou, O Lord, our God, King of the universe, who has not made me a woman." I can best describe my state at that moment of recitation as swallowing crushed glass. And I could not share this with any rabbi or other teacher because I would literally have been crushed by the system. Being the smart little boy I'm told I was, I just kept my mouth shut.
Rais Shah, a transgender Muslim, describes his upbringing at home and at Catholic school in Pakistan.
My earliest memories are of my mother reminding me to speak like a girl. When I first started to talk, I somehow preferred to speak in the male gender because Urdu, my native language, is gender specific. By the time I was 7, I had learned 3 important lessons. In no particular order, I learned that I was different because I knew with an innate certainty that I was a boy, yet could not persuade those around me to recognize this reality, and instead suffered punishing consequences when I tried. I tried everything from earnest, childish arguments that I could never strengthen with proof, to grand tantrums when I rebelled against wearing frilly frocks. Nothing worked. Eventually, I simply evolved into a tomboy. I gave up the arguments and the attempts at reasoning. I remained a girl and acted at every opportunity like a boy. Though Muslim, I attended a Catholic school. In sixth grade, I cajoled my mother into bringing me a pair of Western boots from one of my parents' various foreign trips. So on my birthday, I wore my favorite denim jacket and my new boots to school, the one day a student was allowed to be out of uniform. Just my luck that the headmistress of the middle school decided to take a random tour of the classrooms that particular day. Sister Mary was not one given to extravagant displays of emotion, so that one sharply lifted eyebrow provided a swift disclosure of the extent of her disapproval. Calmly, she informed me that I was to remain within the confines of the classroom for the rest of the day, including recess, and leave only to go straight home, because she didn't want a little boy running around in all the girls' school grounds. This became a defining theme for much of my later life. Blessedly, I looked like a boy if I dressed like one, and I exploited this advantage to its full extent as I grew up.
Reverend Drew Phoenix, a transgender male pastor, transitioned while serving St. John's United Methodist Church in Baltimore, Maryland. He continues to pastor to this church.
I spent the first 46 years of my life homeless. I am talking about the kind of homelessness born of a disconnect between my internal spiritual self and my physical external self. I was born transgender. It is as if I, my spirit, had no place to reside. Friends and family described me before I physically transitioned as not being fully present, as not showing up completely. From as early as 4 or 5 years old, I attempted to communicate this disconnect to my parents. I insisted that I was a boy, even though the doctors who had delivered me had assigned my sex as female. My assigned sex did not match my true gender identity of male. I felt like a boy, acted like a boy, dressed like a boy, and wanted to hang out with the boys. So it was very difficult when I reached puberty to be pressured by family, friends, church, and community to conform, to dress and act like a female. At that time, there was little knowledge about gender identity and certainly no available medical expertise to help me and my family understand the spectrum and complexity of gender identity. And now we understand that the God in whose image we are created is both and at once female and male, encompassing the entire spectrum of what we call gender. Let us make humankind in our image, God said in Genesis.
Reverend Elizabeth McCauley, a United Methodist pastor, describes her father, a United Church of Christ pastor and social justice advocate.
My father was born in the late 1920s. From an early age, he was also much jumbled because the not right in his own sense of being was with him always. While he pursued the boy-child engagements of his culture, he was drawn to the silk and soft of the things that bespoke woman. He had a cache of the sorts of adornments a child born into woman flesh would cherish. He kept them hidden in the dark of his closet, taken out and worn whenever he could get the chance for self-expression. And he was caught by his father. "What sort of sick was this?" he was asked. It was a question familiar to him because it lived with him every day of his life. What sort of sick, indeed? World War II found him serving in the Pacific, playing his tuba, among other things, and when he came back, he enrolled in seminary. What better place to muck about with God? What better way to atone for the shame that would not lose its grip? Along the way, he courted and won the hand of a woman, my mother. She who was beautiful and talented and gracious, and who seemed to know the rights and the wrongs and the absences of gray that made life so painful, perhaps she would keep him safe from himself. They married and moved to California for seminary, and within the first year of their marriage, she too caught him. Far away from home, with young children, and expectations for a good life, and with no help from a world that seemed not to know or speak of this not right. Promises were made. Never again would my father do this thing. Never again. And the door was shut between them and this thing, but not within my father. Jessica would not be denied, try as he might. And always in my home, there was the presence of an unnamed guest, shame, the unspoken between my parents, the shame they each carried, my father's for being this oddity, and my mother's for perhaps feeling somehow at fault for it, That shame was in the very air I breathed. I felt it, but could not name it.
Margaret Blankers, a Presbyterian layperson, describes her journey when her daughter Sarah became Matthew.
As far back as Sarah's grade school days, I can remember the battles we had over the way she dressed. As she grew into a teenager, she usually wore baggy jeans that hid her lovely young woman's shape, oversized t-shirts, and shapeless pants. Once she went to a prom wearing a beautiful red dress and combat boots, making sure a little of the real Sarah peeked through. That's what I suspect now looking back. Well, finally, about 2 years ago, it made sense. My beautiful petite daughter was really my son. At the age of 29, Sarah started transitioning into Matthew. From the time she entered puberty, my child felt she was a boy. Looking back, I can see that the signs were there, not just in clothes and in haircuts, but also in emotions, random comments, and in the way that Sarah expressed herself with others. She was appalled when she grew breasts. She was humiliated by her period and hated wearing a bra, and ultimately, she kept shaving her head.
Reverend Dr. Erin Swenson, a transgender woman pastor and therapist, describes her process trying to change her name on the rolls of the Presbytery of Greater Atlanta.
I told them the story of my first experience in Mom's powder room, when I stuffed tissue in my t-shirt, awed by the vision of myself in the mirror, about how I struggled through adolescence, hung my hopes on my relationship with Sigrid, my wife, and despaired shortly after our wedding. I reviewed the years of lying, denial, and avoidance, and the great cost in terms of my mental health, as well as my family's well-being. They listened intently at my story of stealing Sigrid's hormone pills and at getting fed up with a lifetime of mendacity that led to my visits to Baltimore for counseling and finally accepting that I needed to transition. The raw truth is that I have probably never really known what it is to be male. I have never experienced, as most of my male friends have, the sheer joy and delight of being a male person. I recoiled from my male puberty and hid from any participation in boyish rituals of passage into manhood. I don't really know what it is like to have fun dating girls or women as a man. It was always an awkward and painful experience I avoided as much as possible. Likewise, I will also never really know what it is to be female. I didn't get to experience the friendship of young girls nor the mystery of menarche. I will never really know what it is to date boys as a high school or college girl or the joy of emerging womanhood. I will never know what it is to feel the nurturing power of motherhood.
Jacob Hiro, a transgender man and LGBT activist in Croatia before becoming a seminarian at the Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, California, relates his experience.
The biological fact of my female birth sex did not have to dictate the gender performance of the rest of my life, the way I behaved, whom I fell in love with, what I would call myself. Even back when I did not yet look or sound like a man, the internal ontological reality of my identity was male. I did not feel facial stubble or a flat chest to dictate that reality. I already knew myself to be male. The people who loved me called me by my chosen name, and when they spoke of me, they used male pronouns, even though it was terribly hard for them to remember to do so, since I did not yet look or sound male. They constructed a reality for me in which I was a man, regardless of the essential nature of my birth sex. They recognized the real me, and eventually I was able to use modern medical technology so that my body would catch up with my identity. My first attempt to start transitioning was far from successful. After a few sessions with a gender therapist, I was judged not a good candidate. This therapist was disturbed that I did not perfectly fit the mold of what a transsexual male was supposed to be. Among other things, I did not hate myself enough, and I would not state that I wanted to be a gender normative heterosexual man post-transition. She said that I would probably never be as successful as a man and refused to write the necessary letters that would allow me to start taking hormones and eventually have any of the surgeries available.
Reverend Elizabeth McCauley concludes her description of her father Jessica's story.
We sat in my father's home, the cabin that had been our family's for decades, and she shared her story. I was able to hear the decision-making process around gender reassignment surgery and the reasons she gave for not pursuing that route. I was able to hear her regrets about the hurts experienced by my mother and her church. I was able to hear her share from her heart the ways that she found amazing kinds of grace by being honest with her life. And oh, so powerfully, she shared her sense that God had created her in love and with an artistry both challenging and beautiful. My father, Jessica, died 6 months after our open heart sharing. She had a massive heart attack. Her heart broke partially, I believe, after being weakened by the decades of shame that had so long wrapped her. She had become the most real person I had ever met. I miss her desperately because she knew so well how acceptance can gentle a person into their own skin, and she shared that acceptance lavishly with those she loved. I was such a one. At her funeral was a rainbow throng of people bearing witness to how she helped them see their own amazing grace. She did that for me.
End of dramatic reading A.